On the agenda, we have five issues. Issue 157, the mapping of JSON-LD to RDF, just kind of a status update for Marcus on where we are on that. Issue 184, definition of a JSON-LD processor in the API spec. Marcus, you had said that you wanted to discuss some details on that. Issue 153, defining the error handler behavior. Issue 200, which is the JSON-LD API review by Robin. And then issue 182, graph versus data set, to try and see if we have something concrete that we can move forward on there. Any updates or changes to the agenda? Anything else we should discuss today? We might want to discuss issue 165 at some point. And we might want to discuss something about the algorithms. Let's do that first. So the algorithms have gotten very, 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 very complicated. Some of it is because there's confusing language in it, so there's vague language that's used. We use different language in different places to mean kind of the same thing. Some of it is because we don't have good terminology that we're using throughout the algorithms, and some of it is because we're just missing steps, or the steps have become, you know, we can consolidate steps, reorder steps. Mostly it's because we've been adding to, you know, adding features, and thus the algorithm gets kind of complicated when we do stuff like that. So we know that we need to rewrite the algorithms, or at least revise the algorithms pretty heavily at some point. So I think Dave Longley and I are going to take 3 full days at the end of December or after December 15th, and we're going to go through every single one of the algorithms and update it to include every feature that we have so far, and just kind of check to make sure that, you know, if there's anything vague, we correct it, we introduce new terminology if it's needed. Basically, we're just going to go through and really try and clean up the algorithms such that they're a little more easy to understand than they are now. That's just a heads up to you, Marcus, and maybe Greg, the other editors, that we're going to be doing stuff with it. That doesn't mean if you find a bug or need to add a feature or whatever before then, I mean, definitely do that, because we do need to make sure that all the features are in each one of the algorithms. But just a heads up that we're going to make a full pass through the API spec to update the algorithms to make sure that we do everything that we should be doing. Any comments on that before we move on?
Yeah, I plan to update my processor this week, so I'll allocate quite some time this week for JSON-LD, and maybe I'm able to do something on that before, but yeah, I mean, that just makes it easier for you then afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. And the goal is not to vastly change the algorithms, it's to try and, you know, make them a little easier to understand.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
One somewhat related thing is that hopefully I'll have time to get back to my RDFA lab stuff, which uses JSON-LD under the hood, and I think that I copied some of the JSON-LD implementation stuff that Dave has written a long time ago, and I need to update and use that the recent code for that, and that if I have time, I will hopefully be able to at least read through it and maybe come with some comments. I'd really like to be able to factor out the framing stuff if possible, so if I have time, I'll contact Dave and see if he's interested in something like that.
Okay. Keep in mind that keep in mind we're in the middle of a commercial release, so he probably won't have spare cycles until mid-January.
No, right.
But yeah, definitely seeing him, he'd be interested in talking about it, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'll try to align my Connect implementation as well with that, so I can work a bit on that later on.
Francois, that's a good note. If you have any other comments like that, anything else that we should keep in mind when we are going through the algorithms, please summarize them in an email or just let us know in some way so we can keep our kind of eyes open to issues like that.
Yes.
Okay. Anything else on this before we move on? Okay, issue 157 is up. This is JSON-LD mapping to RDF terminology. Initially, this had been something that Richard Zeganiak was going to write, and I think he wrote something up in a wiki. And since then, Marcus has said that he's going to try and move those what Richard wrote into the JSON-LD syntax spec. Marcus has said that he's going to do that. Yeah. Marcus, would you mind giving a quick overview of that?
Basically, Richard said that he's quite busy at the moment, so he doesn't know when or if he could finish that anytime soon. So in last week's RDF working group, Telecom, I and Craig were present then, and they asked if we could take over that and try to come up with something for this week. So I put something in the syntax spec, which is more or less what Richard had in his draft, but yeah, has a few clarifications and some things which I think he misunderstood. I clarified those, and I think that should explain the whole data modeling in all its details and make it quite easy to map it to RDF. And also wrote that relationship to RDF section, which is quite short at the moment, but I think there are not that many differences, and the basic differences are just that we allow blank nodes in more places than RDF does.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I don't know, I think we need some reviews of those two sections, and I don't know if they are happy with us keeping those blank notes in properties, for example, or as graph names.
We say like should and things like that in the spec, right? They should not use a blank note for a property name. They should not use that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
right?
I included that in the data model, that the graph name should be an IRI, for example, or whenever possible, an edge should be labeled with an IRI.
Morning, Greg.
Hello. Sorry, overslept.
No problem. Okay. So I guess the Francois, you're on the queue.
I just arrived on the queue. Just one comment that we had actually removed verbs such as may, should, or must from the data model because they are not really testable in the context of the syntax. You're in the JSON-LD syntax, and I don't know how they can be directly mapped to something the author needs to follow. I guess my point is that there should be constraints on the syntax itself, but not on the data model, which is created by the syntax. See what I mean?
So you mean,
yeah.
We should include those statements also in the grammar section. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes. These statements should be in the grammar section in the sense that they are constraints that the author should follow, should respect
right.
to author JSON-LD, valid conforming JSON-LD documents. and the result of following the constraints will produce the data model that we want to produce.
Yeah, that's right. So basically you're saying that the data model can support properties, VNodes as properties, but the constraint that we're saying is specifically an authoring constraint, right?
Yes, said differently. What I'm saying is that I think it's fine in the data model to say that in most cases, for instance, an edge will be labeled with an IRI because we could shoot constraint on the grammar to ensure that this is the case. But that's it's a pain to phrase, but that's how it should be phrased in the end, because we can't just put constraint on the data model. It doesn't mean a lot to me.
You're right. Okay. Yep, I agree. Okay. Anything else on this issue? I guess I'm guessing we need to do is just go through and clean up whatever Marcus put in there, add anything that we feel needs to be added, make that change that Francois just suggested, but basically just get some feedback from the RDF working group and iterate until we have something that they like.
Has someone time to review that till tomorrow, perhaps, so that we can, so that someone else had a look at it before we present it to the RDF working group for the first time?
My day is pretty packed today. Day and night is pretty packed. Let me take a look at it.
Speaking of the data model?
Yeah.
Yeah, I looked at it last night, and I thought it looked pretty good. You asked Richard for feedback. Did he take a look at it?
No, he didn't come back to me yet.
I think it would be good to
get
a little first pass from him.
Yeah, I pinged him, but he didn't reply. Maybe he's just traveling or busy, or I don't know.
Busy, I'm sure. I'm trying to recall if we had any strong direction over constraining BNode properties and BNode graph names and things like that. I think that should was adequate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were two or three people who felt strongly, I think, but the majority, said that should be fine.
The only concern I have in the data model is we have blank node all over the place now, and that's a pretty big red flag, or has been a pretty big red flag for people that don't know RDF, because it's this completely new concept that they're not used to. That's why we used unlabeled node previously.
Well, we should be consistent.
What do you mean?
We should consistently use either blank node or unlabeled node.
My preference is to use unlabeled node, even though it's kind of weird when we say an unlabeled node identifier. But blank node is just,
Well, the reason why I use blank node is one, because it sounds weird if you have an unlabeled blank node, unlabeled node identifier, and
right.
RDF Concepts uses blank node. And
I think we could just use blank node consistently, and I think people will figure it out. It's not something that people really have much of a need to use. They'll encounter them only when flattening.
Mm-hmm. wondering if we should have the data model not early in the spec. Because people don't care about the data. I mean, honestly, I don't think people care about the data model. That's not the first thing that they want to read. I think the data model can be an appendix at the very end. I'd be okay with us using blank node identifier if it wasn't put front and center in the spec. So if we move the data model right down to the bottom, right before the RDS section, I think that would be, I'd be happy with that, and then we can use blank node identifier.
I'd be fine with that.
Would
any objections
that
to doing
well,
that?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do that.
Before the RDF section or before the grammar section?
Before the grammar section, I think.
Okay.
Because it seems less complex than the grammar section, so start off easy with this is what the data model is, brief introduction, and then we go into all the details of the grammar. And then relationship to RDF.
The only thing that we lose then is that picture, which gives, I think, a quite simple overview of what it is all about.
We could continue to have the picture in the beginning to say, look, this is what a JSON, you know, I know that there's a, yeah, I do really like the picture in the beginning. But let's move it all the way to the end. Let's try and figure out a way to put a really nice summary picture in the document. But let's not do it now. Let's just move the entire data model section, including the image, down to the bottom.
Okay. As an appendix.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that after the telecom.
Okay. Great, thanks. And then what was the other? The other bit was the relationship to RDF. Which is
but that's
very small
really
section.
Just a few lines. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think this is where the should statement should either we should tell them that authors should use IRIs for graph names. They should use IRIs for properties. Yeah, I think this is good, Marcus. I mean, I think there are minor tweaks that we can make, but overall, it's good. We should, before you present it to the RDF working group, you should definitely put in be able to point to a place in the spec that says that authors should not use blank nodes as property identifiers. Otherwise, I think they're going to come away with the wrong impression that we didn't listen to them.
What do you mean, in the grammar section or in the data model?
It's somewhere in the spec. It doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter where we put it, but we just have to make sure that it exists, that language exists in some form in the spec before you present it to the RDF working group. Because if it's not in the spec, then, you know, you end up in this conversation where we said that we're going to tell authors that they should not be using blank node identifiers for properties, but the spec doesn't say it anywhere.
At the moment, I put it in the other way around. I said, whenever possible, an IRI should be used, because it's weird to say first that an IRI or a blank node can be used, and then a blank node should not be used.
Where do you
say? I put it whenever possible. When, for example, I said, whenever possible, the graph name should be an IRI, or whenever possible, an edge should be labeled with an IRI, even though a blank node is possible.
Okay. Where do you say that? What part in the spec do you say that?
In data model, for example, the third bullet point.
Name we could just strip out whenever possible that graph name should be an IRI. Yeah, I think that's good. I don't know if it's going to be good enough for the RDF working group, but we'll get feedback from them.
Well, I can't imagine a circumstance in case it would be impossible for someone to use an IRI.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So whenever possible seems a little gratuitous.
Yeah, we could just say, it should be
graph
an IRI.
Name should be an IRI.
Yeah. Yep. And hopefully that'll be enough for the RDF working group. If it's not, we should add some reinforcing text somewhere else in the spec.
Yeah, same with the property name, yeah. Those are the only two places where those words occur.
All right. Okay. Anything else on this section before we move on? Or anything else on this topic before we move on? Yeah, good work, Marcus. I think that's we're 80-90% of the way there, and hopefully the rest of it will just be us, each one of us going in and tweaking it slightly and getting some feedback from the RDF working group.
Yeah, let's hope.
Okay, issue 184 is next. This is the definition of the JSON-LD processor in the API spec. Marcus, you had said that you wanted to discuss a few things with the group on this particular one.
Yeah, not anything particular, just, in general. I just introduced a product, which is a JSON-LD processor, and that's the only product the API spec defines. And I said that a JSON-LD processor is a system capable of transforming a JSON-LD document according to the algorithms defined in the API spec. I didn't say anything about parsing because, a processor normally uses a JSON parser for parsing. And I also didn't say anything to that it transforms the data to a data set or, to anything else. It just transforms the documents. And I'm not sure if, that's enough or that's... Yeah.
I thought maybe we wanted two products in there, one of them being... JSON-LD processor and the other one being a JSON-LD API implementation. I don't know what the name we're using for the second one is, but the idea that your implementation is fully conformant with the API, it's basically like your JSON-LD processor, a compliant JSON-LD processor, which means that you follow the algorithms, precisely, or you follow the algorithms, or you are a JSON-LD processor, plus you are an implementation of the JSON-LD API, a conforming implementation of the JSON-LD API, which means that you support all of the things like .compact with the proper arguments to that function, .expand to RDF from RDF, basically the web IDL in what's going to be an appendix, the back of the document. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, could you say something like your JSON-LD processor is must be algorithm compliant with the algorithm. It can also be compliant with the API.
Right, but it might help to create a different conformance product for that. So we can do what you're saying, Nicholas, but then it's kind of weird when you say, yeah, I'm a conforming JSON-LD processor, but I don't implement the API, or yes, I'm a conforming JSON-LD processor, and I do implement the API. seems like there are two products there rather than just one.
Yeah, I can see
like one product plus option, or there are two products, and I think we should just go with there are two products around.
Yeah.
Do we really need two products? I mean,
when you're talking about conformance, typically, that's the way it's done. Correct me if I'm wrong there,
yeah.
Francois, but that's what I've seen in most specs.
No, but what I was thinking about is just having a product which also complies to the API. If someone doesn't use the API, well, it's not conformant.
Are you saying that you can have a product that's conforming to the API, but you're not conforming to the algorithms?
No, I said we just define one product which has to be both conformant to the API and to the algorithms.
We can't do
we
that
don't separate
because
that.
We can't do that because Avon doesn't want that to happen. He wants to create a Python like RDF lib. He wants to create a synchronous version of the API, and he wants to do it in Python, and he wants to do it in a way that's compatible with RDF lib, which means that he wants to say that it's conformant with the spec, but he doesn't want to use any of the API definitions that are in the spec.
Okay, so what's the point then of having something which is also compliant to the API?
So you can say that you're compliant with the API. So you have implemented everything. You are a conforming JSON-LD processor, and you're a conforming JSON-LD API. You're both things. Whereas all Avon cares about is I'm a conforming JSON-LD processor, and I have my own API that I've implemented.
But that kind of sounds like there are, you know, one is the better product than the other. The other is just partially conformant.
Not all languages can implement the APIs in that fashion, whereby the IDL isn't that generic, and especially the parts about callbacks just isn't. So I definitely think that we should separate the two and distinguish between processor algorithm compliance and API compliance. And I suspect that Manu's terminology is the way to go about that.
Right. Francois, you're on the queue.
Roughly to insist that this is just it's a way to defend the API. So it's a way to keep the API in the spec, having two products. Not having two products means we're going to face a war with the RDF working groups, it seems, if we only have one class of product that implements both the processing and the API. The algorithms and the API. So really having two classes of products is a way to keep the API. That's how we should see it, not as a way to, well, it diminishes the value in a way, but it's a way to keep the API in the end, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Any other thoughts on this? Okay, so do we want to do a proposal on this? JSON-LD API specification will define two products. One, a JSON-LD processor. Two, a JSON-LD API. Do we want to call it a JSON-LD API implementation? Or how do people? An implementation of the JSON-LD API.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is there a way to say, like, I don't know, having something like a JSON LD processor which is also compliant to the API or conformant to the API or implement the API. So instead of having two distinct products, say we have one product but two levels of support or two levels of conformancy for those product for that product.
It would be good to say that the one depends on the other. I mean, it would be senseless for an API implementation not to implement the algorithms or the effect of the algorithms.
I guess it's similar to like LDL versus LFull.
Or DOM level 1 and DOM level 2, right?
Yeah.
Or CSS 1 and CSS 2. Although those are not really analogous, I guess.
Those are versions, aren't they?
I think it's rather something like a processor capable of handling the XML info set, which is the baseline, and then if it also implements the DOM API upon that, then it's a full DOM implementation. And in the same way, we have the JSON-LD processor, which implements the JSON-LD processing. Rather, I don't know, when we say algorithm, do we mean verbatim, or how do you say verbatim? How do you say that word?
Yeah, verbatim.
Verbatim.
All right.
At least in sometimes. American English, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's freaky sometimes. I realize that I've written a word 1,000 times and never actually pronounced.
That happens to me, too.
Yeah. Well, the gist of it is that, do we say processor, I mean the algorithms, you don't have to implement them verbatim, right? You only have to have the same effect or outcome.
Right, yep, that's right. The API is a little different, meaning that the signatures you have to implement exactly like they are in the spec. So the signatures have to be exactly the same. And again, the algorithms, it doesn't matter if you have a completely different algorithm, as long as the output is the same, that's what matters. I'm writing a proposal now. The proposal is the JSON-LD API specification will define two products, a JSON-LD processor and an implementation of the JSON-LD API, which is dependent on a valid JSON-LD processor implementation.
Yeah.
Does that seem right?
It's a weird name for a product.
could you say an JSON-LD processor and an JSON-LD API compliant JSON-LD processor?
Could be a JSON-LD interface.
You call it an application programming interface, which then becomes a JSON, the JSON-LD API.
Well, the product of the spec is the API, but an implementation of the API. If I implement the API,
you have a JSON-LD processor, which is compliant with the.
Yeah.
Can we say a JSON-LD processor with a compliant API? Or a standardized API or conformant API or something?
Asynchronous interface?
No.
JSON-LD processor plus API? JSON-LD processor and API. Okay, JSON-LD processor or a JSON-LD API compliant processor.
How about level 1 and level 2?
but the levels are still both about an API.
No, level one is about the processing algorithm. Level two is about the doing that and having a conforming API.
I think people might get confused because that's not how DOM level one and DOM level two work. Right, because they're more like versions, and each version has its own additional processing rules.
Well, maybe the HTML in its implementation of the DOM API is the closest. How do they define that?
That's level one and level two. What about a JSON-LD processor and JSON-LD processor and API as the product?
I could live with that, I think.
The thing Marcus just put in, or the one I just said?
Either.
Yeah, I don't have a very strong feeling one way or the other. JSON-LD processor conforms to JSON-LD API. Implementing the JSON-LD API, I think, is better from what Marcus just said. But it might be more succinct to say a JSON-LD processor and API.
But then it's hard to distinguish if you say, is this the JSON-LD API? No, this is the processor. The API is the definition.
How about JSON-LD? Well, what about what Greg said then? Then just JSON-LD interface. You have a JSON-LD processor and you have a JSON-LD interface. JSON-LD interface is dependent on an available JSON-LD processor. I kind of like that. It's short, succinct.
The only problem I have with interface is that an interface normally doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
How about JSON-LD library?
Yeah. You could implement a JSON-LD library and not be conformant with the spec. I think many people might that are only concerned with the RDF conversion, for instance.
JSON-LD
What about if we call it a JSON-LD library if you are not compliant to the API and the JSON-LD processor, if you are compliant with the API?
Oh, that's a good idea. I think that's a good idea.
Would you say that again?
So if you're not conformant to the API, then you implement a JSON-LD library. If you're also compliant to the API, then you are implementing a JSON-LD processor.
How about swapping out library with implementation? A JSON-LD implementation or a JSON-LD processor? And processor is saved for the API implementation.
Like this? I like that. Out of all of the things we discussed, I like that one the best.
I'm lukewarm.
We can always change the name later. I think this is good for now. We shouldn't spend too much time bike shedding this. If we come up with a better language, we can just change it at that point. But I think this is, it's short and fairly clear.
Should it number two could say a JSON-LD processor, which is dependent on a valid JSON-LD implementation and implements the API.
Yes. I will change the resolution to say that, unless somebody has an objection. Okay. I think that's done. Next up, issue 153, define error handler behavior. Okay, so this is something that Marcus had suggested quite a while ago, saying that the error handler behavior that I was suggesting was too complicated if we were not going to actually implement, if we didn't know we were going to implement the feature right now, the error handler behavior was pretty complicated. So perhaps we could simplify the error handler behavior to be a little easier for people to understand. Robin Bergeon agreed with Marcus, as did Dave Longley. So I'm going to back off this more complex error handler behavior thing. And I think we've got three proposals on the table, only two of which are really so it looks like they have a broad support. So, Marcus, did you want to say anything on this before we just do straw poll? Before we straw poll?
No, I think the proposals are quite clear.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, first proposal is...
Do you have them at
first
hand,
proposal
or
is, I do. I was just attempting to get it. First proposal is to simplify the error handling mechanism by passing an error object to the callbacks, which only consists of an error code and an optional error message containing additional information for debugging. So it's just error objects, pretty simple now. All right, and the next proposal is to just stop processing when an error is triggered, when there's an unrecoverable error. So basically, we have some errors that we can recover from. We will recover from those. Well, yeah. Maybe we need to talk about this one a bit. It's the
well,
question
if we can
is,
recover,
what,
it's
what
not an error.
Okay. All right. So. So we're basically saying anything that's recoverable.
I mean, if there was list of lists, for instance, I might be able to recover from that, but that's certainly an error.
That's true.
I think that certainly if it's an error in one processor, it should be an error in all processors. That's why I basically was going to be a minus one on that one, even though I saw that there was support otherwise.
Okay.
I implement a in my processors, my RDF processors, I implement a validate option. And what validate means is it turns on very strict processing, and it will generate an error if there are problems. That can still mean that triples are generated. And from a turtle processor, for instance, triples are generated all along the way. But at the very end, there will be an error.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with Robin's suggested change to us, that wouldn't be the case. We wouldn't generate any triples if there was an error,
mm-hmm.
I presume, unless we generate error after the call was made with the callback was made with the triples.
Should the processor stop processing local the current object, but then continue?
No.
Abort processing at the current element level. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah.
My feeling is you process as much as you can, so that you can find as many errors as you can.
Right.
But having a way to say stop processing when you encounter an error is a, you know, I often don't want to wade through 10 screens full of error messages, particularly if they're all byproducts of the first one.
Well, then what we can do is have the flag. Well, that means that we have this callback mechanism all of a sudden again, right?
I mean,
we have to say whether something's recoverable or not, or whether we want the processor to recover or not.
No, I see. I don't do that.
A flag.
I do it as a runtime flag, so it is an option that is passed into the processor, how it behaves.
If we define the default behavior to stop at the first error, I mean, nothing would prevent the library to include a flag or some configuration option to continue afterwards, but by default it would just stop, and all conformant implementations should do so in the default configuration.
Why should that be the default?
Because otherwise we have to specify how we handle each separate case in all the algorithms.
Each separate what case? If there's an error.
Well, if there was one error, what kind of error, how do we continue and all that stuff. And if we just say we stop at an error, we don't have to do that.
I believe in all the cases, if we encounter an error, the key value pair being processed currently is just ignored, and you go to the next one.
I don't think it's always that easy.
It might not always be that easy, but I think in the vast majority of cases it is that easy.
Well, if you have a list of lists, for example, then you did already something. Do you remove the property that you processed before? And the second one, which causes the list of lists, what do you do then, for example?
You remove that entire list and continue processing. So if you have an array with A, B, C, and then an array in it, you process A, B, and C, and then you hit a list of lists, you ignore that entire list and go to the next element.
Well, but you could, for example, have two IRIs which map to the same term, for example. And you have already processed one of the IRIs. And if you process the second IRI, then you get a collision or a list of lists. What do you do then with the first one? Do you rebirth that step, or?
I think it would be safer to say that we just stop, because I think Marcus is right. There are cases where the current object won't be the expected results if part of it fails, and that bubbles all the way up to the root. So you can't guarantee if a failure occurs deep down that everything doesn't get affected.
Okay, so are we still talking about halting on all errors, or are we talking about there being some errors that we have to halt on? Like list of lists being one of those types of errors.
In my opinion, if there is a clear way to recover from an error, then it's not an error. It's just, I don't know what to call it, but that's not an error. An error is if there is something like a list of lists which we just don't support, or if there is an add value object which also has an add ID, for example, then we just stop.
I guess there are recoverable errors and there are fatal errors.
Yeah, but I wouldn't like to call recoverable errors as errors.
You would like to continue to call recoverable errors as errors?
No, I would not.
Or you would not. Okay, so how do people know that that error condition has been hit?
Well, it's not an error.
Well, what I'm saying is that something gets the data's lossy at that point, right? You end up dropping something, or in there are some cases where you end up dropping something. How does the developer know that something was dropped?
For example, if we have a term which has a type mapping and a language mapping, we could say that type has we prefer type, or and then we ignore language, or we define that as an error and just stop. So we either rely on precedence in that case, or it's an error.
Well, I think in that case we'd rely on the precedence because you have, I mean, the algorithms can be worded in such a way where that just naturally drops out. You just check to see if type exists first, and if type doesn't exist, then you check to see if language exists in the algorithm.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I don't see that as an error, for example. It's just the rules are that way, so it's not an error.
It seems like we want to make it, at least to me, it seems like we want to make linting this stuff easy. And it seems to me that if we go this route, then all of a sudden processors can't optionally raise linting errors as they're going through. Because so let's say there are two classes of errors. One of them is fatal errors, and the other ones are linting errors, or they're warnings, processing warnings. So we could say that, you know, there are two types of things that can be raised here, warnings and errors. Warnings are recoverable, errors are not recoverable.
I don't think it's the job of a processor to raise those warnings. That would be a linter or something.
Well, if we look at RDFA, for instance, we do have warning and error classes, and I don't think there's ever a case where a processor must stop processing if it encounters an error. Furthermore, we have a processor graph where we deposit that information, which we might want to consider as well, since if you are a processor and not an API processor implementing the API, it still would be nice to be able to get those errors.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But that would be a sort of a separate thing.
Yeah,
I don't have a problem with using error for something that is recoverable. And I think that is why a term such as fatal error is common, because there are error cases that you cannot recover from, and they're fatal.
One more thing to add here. I'm really concerned. I'm concerned about creating any kind of technology that doesn't go as far as it possibly can. And I don't know if anyone's actually making this argument, but just to be clear, you know, the problem with XHTML was that when you hit an error, it just stopped. You know, the entire processor caught on fire, full stop. Looking back, it was a mistake to do that. Really, what the processor should have done is that they should continue until they absolutely cannot, or in fact, in the HTML5 case, they just continue, and they will completely rewrite your data to get it into some kind of form that's valid, that is, you know, displayable in a web browser. So I think that JSON-LD should very much follow that model. You know, it doesn't matter if half of your data is completely modified and changed. What you get back at the end is something that the developer can work with. And it's up to the developer to basically be like, oh, yeah, I screwed up. I need to go and fix this issue in my markup. And the processor should try and aid them as much as it can by you know, generating warnings. At least some processors will end up generating warnings saying, you know, this is what went wrong. This is why your data got modified so heavily. I think having both of those things built into a technology makes the technology more robust. It makes it easier for people to kind of figure out what's going on, rather than them having to go and open up a different website and then figure out, you know, and then run the linter on their data and then figure out, oh, you know, here's where the error is. I really think we should be providing that type of functionality and tooling to developers. Just build it in. Another example of that being a really good idea is the Google Chrome developer tools. Every Chrome web browser comes with developer tools, and if you have an issue on a web page and you're fairly knowledgeable, all you need to do is bring up the debugging window and you can see what went wrong. You don't have to just sit there guessing as to what's wrong with the page. So I think there's a very, very strong argument here for providing some way of getting a message to the developer on non-fatal errors. And I definitely don't think we should go the route of saying that, you know, we have these things that are called fatal errors. Even list of lists, I'd much rather the data be completely, like, messed up rather than the processor stop processing.
Yeah, but what do you do with that messed up data then? You can't use it anyway. And we have that issue now for I don't know how many months, and we haven't been able to come up with anything. I don't think we can do that now in a month or in 2 months.
With what?
Well, all the error handling stuff. That issue is at least open since half a year now.
Well, I think that's
2 weeks ago we decided to say that all the algorithms operate just on well-formed documents. They are just specified for well-formed documents, and they say nothing about the other non-well-formed documents. So
I see what you're saying.
Now,
I think what's complicated there is specifying complex behavior for a callback to handle these different cases. That's why it's been open. And that's why I brought up the thing about the processor graph, because I think, you know, for instance, in testing, as we do in RDFA, it would be useful to be able to look that if the appropriate options are used, that the result includes the errors that are the warnings and errors that are expected in a named graph, which is, again, what RDFA does. It's the complexities of an API callback that I think is what's caused the big delay in the API called error handling case.
I completely agree with all of that. I just don't think we need to do all of that in 1.0. You can, of course, implement it in your processor, but I would prefer to keep it as simple as possible in the spec for the moment, and we can always improve it later on. But
Go ahead. What Greg's saying is that we're trying to create a mechanism such that the people that don't want to give any kind of linting feedback don't need to do that. They don't need to implement that. But people that do want to provide linting feedback, like Greg, have the capability of doing that through the same kind of, you know, issue reporting mechanism.
By the statement in the current spec where we say non-well-formed documents, the algorithms are not specified for non-well-formed documents. If we just have to treat well-formed documents, no error would ever be triggered, for example.
That's true, but how does Greg get that message to the developer in a standard way? That there was a warning that he did something to fix the document.
Well, can't he just report that error code plus that debugging message and then just continue instead of stopping? That's a normal.
Is that a warning? Yes, he can do that.
Well, he can decide that it's not specified by the specification. That's all I want to say. The specification doesn't say anything about that. A specification
identify that.
A non-well-formed document, how that's processed, what's the outcome of a non-well-formed document.
Yeah, and I guess what we're saying is we're not going to define what that behavior is, but how does Greg report to the developer that he did something to correct the document? What mechanism is used for that? Is it the error callback?
He can use whatever mechanism he thinks is useful. He can use the error callback. He can use another mechanism. It's not specified.
Okay. So then are we saying that the error callback, you're allowed to send kind of warning messages to the error callback, things that are not fatal errors?
Well, you send error objects. They have a code and a message. That's all we say.
Well, maybe they need to indicate if it's an error warning or fatal. for that matter.
Yeah, and that's what I think. I really only think that we need two things. It's either a warning or a fatal error, right? But so the weird thing, Marcus, with the argument you're making is that you're saying, well, the only thing that we need, or the only input to the algorithms are well-formed documents. And at that point, why do you need an error callback, right?
Well, list of lists, for example, they can also core in well-formed documents.
Uh-huh. Right, but it's an invalid document, so the algorithms don't specify that, so why do you need an error callback?
No, the input is a valid document. The output would be an invalid document.
But lists of lists aren't a valid JSON-LD document, are they? For the grammar selection?
Well, but if you come back with a context which is completely valid and you have a specific input document, then the output could be a non-well-formed document because the result would be a list, would contain lists of lists.
Hmm.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. If
your input document contains a list of lists, then it's not well-formed, yeah.
Nicholas, you're on the queue.
I'm wondering where we're going. Is the second proposal, it seems that this is a discussion about whether or not that prohibits, for example, Greg's processor from doing anything if proposal 2 is interpreted as processing must be stopped after an error is triggered. But does it say when an error is triggered?
Do the algorithms? No, I don't think they do. Except for the list of lists case.
Yeah. I mean, is there any other case?
There are a number of cases that where the context is like invalid, but most of that stuff is fixed up. Like, let's say someone puts in the context, you know, foo, and then they put colon and a number. That's clearly invalid, but it's something that the processor is probably going to fix by just ignoring that. It doesn't match the grammar, and it'll probably drop it, and it should probably report that an error, that a warning, it should report a warning of some kind. Greg, you're on the queue.
I was just going to say, regarding things that aren't fatal errors or considered warnings, a caution against that. In RDFA, for instance, I think we recently agreed to describe the redefinition of a prefix as a warning. And I might imagine that that's something that could come up in JSON-LD in the future. Warnings are used for things that are sort of informational that in some context might be considered an error but really don't pose any problems. I think the other thing to consider is there might be things, for instance, a malformed IRI, unless we're doing extremely strict checking of the IRIs. It could be malformed, so a processor should be able to classify that as an error, but not a fatal error.
Okay, so are we clear that there are two classes of things that could probably be sent to this callback? I guess that it seems to me I'd object to us going forward with something that only allows you to report errors and no warnings, because I think it's, you know, the various products that all of us have worked on, we've almost always ended up needing this feature where you have the capability of reporting a warning and the capability of reporting an error. It could be something as simple, so first off, is there agreement that there are two classes of things we're talking about here?
What are the two classes?
Warnings and errors, or errors and fatal errors, whatever we're talking about.
Or three classes. warnings, errors, and fatal errors.
Yeah. Although then I think we might confuse people if we go that far with it.
Well, I mean.
Nicholas, you're on the queue.
I'm just thinking about the two very different situations where you probably will use a JSON-LD processor. One is during development, and during development you probably want to handle all kinds of other data, and in some services you want to do that as well. Whereas, and then you would want to say that raise a warning and continue on any errors. And in the other case, you want something to stop on the first error, where you have a service integrating data from many sources, and you must, and you know that people rely on that service. You cannot allow anything ambiguous. But I wouldn't want to define something in the spec so that one of these cases is excluded.
Marcus, were you going to respond to something before that?
Yeah, I mean, like, it goes in the same direction as Nicholas said, but in development, for example, you would like to have much more debug output. It's not just about warnings and errors. So, but I don't think we need to specify all that in the spec.
Why?
Well, because it depends on the implementation, I think.
And but we know that all implementations are going to have a warning, are going to, we know that there, a good chunk of implementations are going to want to report warnings in addition to errors. Right?
Well, what about debug output then? Like changing the local, the active context, for example.
I don't know if I wouldn't put that in the same class as I don't think that is going to be a. I don't think many implementations are going to want to do that. Mostly, just looking at the software libraries that people use. I don't think many of the software libraries have a debugging mode like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I just can't see how a warning is any useful if you're not in development mode. Like in production, why does the warning bring you any advantage, or how should you make use of such a warning? Why do we have
to
specify?
For example, if you go and browse using Google Chrome and bring up the console, if you hit a site that's in HTTPS mode and that site requests something from an HTTP site, you will get a warning saying exactly which request resulted in the HTTPS security warnings being shown. So
yeah, but that's the developer console. That's
right,
not how the browser normally reports errors.
Right, but there's nothing to say that these warnings need to be surfaced up to the person using a browser. If they're available to the developer, if they choose to show it to the person, and if they don't care, then they just ignore the warning and continue to
Is that error reporting, for example, somewhere specified? No, they just do it in their implementation. It's not specified neither in HTTP nor in HTML. They just report it because they noticed it and they output it to their developer console.
But you don't want to always have a console log in your library. Like most libraries are silent. The way they get information to developers is not through console log statements. They get it to the developer through a callback of some kind, right?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is Chrome, for example, doesn't report error because the specifications it implements specifies that it has to report those warnings, but because Google decided that their implementation reports that stuff.
Okay, so I don't know if we're
I would be fine with putting that stuff in. I just don't believe that we can do that in 2 months and get something which has any value.
Well, I mean, the only thing that we need to put in, I think the only thing that Greg would need for his processor is a flag on the issue reporting mechanism that says whether something's a warning or an error, or a critical or fatal error. I think that's the only thing that's required. Everything else stays the same.
A flag on the error or a flag to the processor?
A flag on the what we're calling an error right now. It could be an issue or something like that. We could call it an issue. And there are two types of issues. There are warnings and errors. Errors are fatal, warnings are not.
I disagree. I tried to make my case that I believe there are three classes: warnings, errors, and fatal errors. A malformed IRI is probably not a warning; it's probably an error. However, it's likely not fatal.
But isn't it easier to just have a strict mode on or off? And if you want nuances, you can run with the strict mode off, and in your callback, decide any kind of level for problems, and just throw an error if you want it to fail, even if it runs with strict mode off.
Yeah, I guess this is the difference between what the needs of the API are versus the needs of the processor. If I'm running this through an API, then certainly it's got specific things to do based upon the requirements of the API. But the processor needs to support these various things to be able to work at all. And so if I were, for instance, not implementing the API, but I was implementing a conforming processor, then I probably also have to deal with those types of use cases, just not in a way as defined by the API. But that still does allow for a processor emitting warnings, errors, and fatal errors.
Okay, so what would need to be changed in the current proposals?
We'd add in addition to a code and a message, we would add some indication or event type describing as being a warning, an error, or a fatal error. It might not even need to say it's a fatal error. It's an error that happens to be fatal, and you know that because it's the only thing that ever happened. I guess that sort of leads up Robin's question of, well, how do we know when processing is done if everything's asynchronous?
Well, that's the answer to that question is easy. It's just a callback that's called, or we return back all the quads, right?
Yeah.
Either one would work.
Except in a fatal error, you wouldn't return back the quads or the document.
Right.
So you need to know. That's why you sort of need to know that a fatal error is one in which that does terminate processing versus one in which an error condition was found, not a warning. But you can expect either more errors or warnings and or a result.
Actually, you know what? So Node.js does this a lot. In the final callback, the first argument is always an error, and if there were no errors, you would just get back a null object for error. But if there was an error, you would get back the error, and then you could get back a partial list of quads that were generated up to the error. That would be one way to solve that issue. And it's very, very much in the vein of, you know, Node.js's continuation style calling processing. Did that make sense?
Yeah, so that we would always call, after signaling an error, you would always call the completion callback. It just,
yep.
If it was null, then you could probably determine that, well, it was a fatal error. Or,
well, no, if it
was
partial
results,
no,
you wouldn't know. Yeah.
Well, if it were null, if the final callback, if the error condition, if the first argument is always error, if that is null, there were no errors.
Oh, I see.
If it is not null, then there was an error, and then you might have some data, but it's not the complete data because there was an error. What I'm saying is that you don't need the error callback in order to know if there was an error during processing, because you will get. But that means that it'll, you know, you'll always get the fatal error at the very end. But I'm arguing for something I don't think anybody has said that they actually want. Okay, so it sounds to me like all we need is just another flag on the error, or whatever we're calling it.
Well, yeah. What does that flag change then? I mean, isn't the error code enough? For example, like in HTTP, you have code 500 is critical, so to speak. Or,
well, if you want to apply semantics to the codes, that would be a way to do it.
Yeah, I'm numerical error codes are not very developer friendly. Yeah, so let's not do that. Let's just do simple strings. I mean, we just need three strings here, right? Warning error and fatal error.
Well, at some point we have to define either an enum or constants for the errors, don't we?
Yes.
I mean, there is a one-to-one mapping anyway between the error code and the severity, I think.
I don't know. So we're spending a lot, we're burning a lot of time on this, and I don't think we meant to, and I don't think we're going to be able to resolve this in the next 4 minutes, 5 minutes. So how about we go back to the issue tracker and work through some proposals on this? Any objections to doing that? Yeah, and we're pretty much out of time for today, I think.
The only objection I have to doing that is that's exactly what we did. We had kind of agreement on the issue tracker, and now we discussed it, I don't know, 45 minutes, and we are in a worse situation than we have been before. So I don't know if that really...
Yeah. Oh, that's the way these things go. Sometimes you go to the straw poll and you find out that there are actually things that people didn't think about when they were filling out the issue tracker thing.
We should make the proposals more concrete. So like... with code examples or whatever it's needed to make it really concrete, not just like two or three sentences.
Yeah, I agree. So maybe someone should fill out exactly what the API, what the error object is, and then we can kind of talk about that. Okay. But yeah, let's do this on the issue tracker. Try and actually do code examples and just look at what the error handler looks like there. Next issue is the JSON-LD API review, which I don't think we're going to be able to get much done on. Maybe the last bit of the call we can talk about the graph versus data set discussion and the current status on that. From my understanding, the RDF working group has effectively kicked the issue back to us and said that if we want any progress on issue, I think it's 105 or something, that we need to drive it from the JSON-LD side of things. It seems to me that we have our, I think our view of this is pretty aligned, meaning the proposal that Mark has put in there states in the syntax spec that JSON-LD can be used as an RDF graph source. A consumer would just use the default graph and ignore all named graphs in that case. This would allow a server to use both Turtle and JSON-LD in content negotiation. Does it seem like we have agreement on that? I mean, that seems like a fairly reasonable way to resolve this issue.
Yeah, provided that the RDF group thinks that does solve the questions raised in issue 105.
Yeah.
They're
telling
us that we need to drive that one, and I think that this is the appropriate resolution. We should have a resolution out of this group that is the expected behavior of processors that are looking for a graph.
Okay, so should I just put the proposal in here and we can do a straw poll on it?
Yeah.
Just to be clear, that means that a JSON-LD document is still a data set, right? But it can also be used as a graph source.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was there any other reaction to my restatement of the named graph examples that sort of inverted the data and the generated at triple?
I haven't looked at it yet.
Here's the link.
I think it feels sensible.
You mean the one before Francois?
Yeah.
I don't know what we're trying to do with that example.
An example of why you might use named graphs, and it, I think, reads a little better in the spec the way it is, but the sort of the provenance information generated at, in that case, went into the default graph, whereas the asserted data went into a named graph. And if that was the case, that sort of runs counter to this resolution. So that's why I inverted this by putting the asserted triples in the default graph and then added a name graph with the name being that of the document, which includes the generated at triple. It seemed like an example that illustrated the type of effect you would have by applying this rule.
Yeah.
Although
if you read in example 50 with this resolution in place, you wouldn't get any data, right?
Right.
Well, you get provenance data.
Yeah, you would get provenance data, exactly.
Yeah, the inversion of what you're after, probably.
But that, if I understand it correctly, that would imply that default graph's name is the same IRI as the document, right?
No. Default graph has no name.
Yeah, but from reading your example, it is like that.
You specified that the
document's IRI... So you put the data in the default graph, and then you say the document's IRI was generated at. So you're not saying something about the default graph, but about the document.
Well, I don't know how else to refer to the default graph.
It's a default graph, and then it's a named graph with the same name as that of the document.
You'd say, but the document is not a named graph. Like the document, the body of the document is in a default graph. this just goes back to what I had been saying for the last week or two, is that these provenance use cases are important, and it therefore it's we need to be able to state information in a named graph which talks about the content of the default graph. Otherwise, yeah, you're not going to find people actually using the default graph to state data. Now, maybe there's some other way to do it. This was just what came to me, and it's clear that we're entering bike shedding now. So I think that we have a resolution here, but it doesn't close the issue until I think people have had a chance to weigh in on this use case.
Well, there's a real hard problem here, given that if we resolve it the way we just voted for, and I mean, if most systems that store RDF natively do so in named graphs, and it might be that they think it's sensible to expose the data exactly like the example 50 and the spec looks like right now, because that's how it's stored internally. I mean, it is within the name graph with that name. And somewhere else, quite possibly in their default graph, is the provenance information for that name graph.
Well,
so
maybe,
example
maybe,
50...
Maybe we don't agree on this resolution then.
It might be... No, well, it depends, because that's the problem with name graphs for me. You use them in a different way when you manage your data internally. The question is, if you expose the data set, I mean, the quoting that the data set handling is all about in documents, like in this example, are you exposing data in the best way possible? It might be that your example in the issue here is the better way to, and that is the way it should be advocated if you want to expose data in a way that is equivalent to what you would want and what you would get if you asked for the turtle representation for that name graph. So you would not send, if you ask the system for the document, you would get the document back with the data within that document in a default graph. You would not get a quoting of the data in that document. I think it's more sensible to ask systems to do that.
Alternative proposal before, which didn't seem to have much uptake, was that the result of the data set, a data set containing named graphs, would be to just use the graph whose name is the same as the document, if it exists, because that would allow for the original statement of the of this example 50. Which I think probably is more natural, but that's more complicated, and I don't, you know, in the RDF working group, I think there was even some umbrage taken at trying to define the semantics of these things.
Yeah, I think that the problem with the name, trying to use that, is that it's a bit brittle, given that you might save that data somewhere else, and then you don't know where you fetched it from. And when you look into that, you only see the quoting. You don't have any base keyword or anything to rely on to set that, so you can't compare that at all. And then you don't know. I think you have had another proposal which said that, well, if you want to treat a JSON-LD document as a graph, just use the union of all the graphs within that JSON-LD dataset. Not only the default graph.
I think we're out of time for today. I think, Greg, I don't think that there's disagreement on this proposal. I think that there are nuances that we need to hammer out. So I think the proposal that we just resolved is fairly general, and what we're talking about is what what would be the best way for a system to present this information in both JSON-LD and Turtle so that such that there was no confusion as to what data is in the default graph. And I think that what you put into the issue tracker is correct. That would probably be the best way to represent the data. Personally, I need to think about it a bit more to figure out if that's, you know, the way I view this stuff is that it's really system dependent based on how the system wants to expose name graphs, if it wants to do that at all. And if it's going to do that, I think there are some best practices for that. I just don't know if it's our job to figure out what those best practices are.
I think that my gut tells me that systems should avoid exposing name graph in regular usage. If they do, they do some kind of import-export synchronization, something like that.
There's one issue with that, Nicholas, and that's for the digital signature case. Like, we're going to be exposing name graphs all over the place for digital signatures. That's going to be the primary way, and we're just not going to use Turtle because you can't represent it very nicely in Turtle, so it's not going to be used. Our approach is different. What happens if someone wants to content negotiate for Turtle? Tough. You can't express the information nicely in Turtle, so we're just not going to support it. We'll support Trig, but not Turtle.
Could we move this stuff to a separate issue?
Yeah, we could. Let's wait to see what the RDF working group comes back with. I mean, it's just this is one of those issues where I feel like the ball's kind of been tossed into our court, and any resolution we make is going to be met with, you know, corner case opposition.
That's exactly the reason why I would like to split those two issues, I think.
I guess the concern I have is splitting into two issues isn't going to change what's going to happen, unless I'm not seeing something. Why are we splitting it into two issues? Or what's your reasoning for splitting it into two issues?
Well, because one is how we can use a dataset syntax in content negotiation with graph synthesis, and the other is how to present data in a sensible way in a dataset syntax. And I wouldn't like to see those two conflated in the discussion, because I think that this issue is already controversial enough, I would say.
That's fine. I'm fine with splitting it into two issues. Does anybody else object to doing that? All right, let's split it into two issues. Hopefully we'll be able to resolve one of them with the resolution we just made. Okay, we're 10 minutes over. Anything else that we need to discuss before adjourning for this week? All right, guys, thanks much. And I think that over the next few weeks, I think the editors are just going to be nose down in the specs trying to implement as many of these resolutions we've made over the past couple of months. All right, thanks, guys. Talk to you next week.
Bye.
Yeah,
bye. Thanks.
Bye.